So I think I'm still keeping within the general parameters of the theme, am I? Harmonizing the spiritual path or something? Or? I think what I meant when I thought of that was that there's various aspects to spiritual practice. And practically speaking, you know, everybody probably comes to spiritual practice from their own perspective, of course. Yeah, maybe some people, they have a physical ailment, yeah, and they want to look for some solution to it or way to relate to it or deal with it. And others are maybe going through a more emotional crisis, and some are curious or confused or whatever. I think I came to the spiritual path from confusion. Being a university student, of course, that's... Especially a failed one. I was really confused. What to do next? And so, as far as the meditation exercises go, you know, it's and also probably we have our own preference. Like some people would, you know, they say, "Oh, I want to come here and learn about the mind." Well, really, in order to be able to learn about the mind, generally speaking, it's helpful to be grounded in the body first. If you have a good grounding in the body, this, as I mentioned, is not conceptual, so it gives you a good foundation, a good basis, then to be able to observe the mind non-conceptually. Otherwise, you're just thinking about your mind, not really observing, you're just thinking about your mind. And another aspect of it is, when we have some experience of being aware of sensations, feeling tones, then we come to states of mind, you can kind of cross-reference them because they're all interrelated. So if you just, some of these, say, states of mind particularly, you know, generally we've only been able to look at them one-dimensionally, you know, so very hard for us to get any perspective on them. But then if you look at how they manifest in the body, oh, get a different angle on it, especially some of our stronger issues we have. You know, we have a certain perspective on them. That's probably why they're issues, actually, why they're problems in our life. We don't get the big picture. We can't see the bigger picture of it. The Buddha gave us one helpful hint, and anyway, was that everything is a product of cause and effect. This causal process is there. So if we are aware of one particular issue in our mind, you know, and in these exercises of developing mindfulness, there's stages. First of all, you're aware of sensation. And then what's the cause of that sensation? And what will lead to its passing away? To get the wider picture of it. And then they're interrelated. So we get, now we've got, you know, multidimensional approaches to awareness, huh? Different parts of our experience and the causes and the what leads to their cessation. So we have many possibilities to be able to look at some of this stuff in different angles, get different perspective on it. It's all coming from ourself, you see. And we tend to get locked into it, me and my object, me and my problem. Then you get locked into it that way, and you're only seeing one part of it. And many times that getting locked into it, you know, we just can't shake ourselves out of it. But watch the breath. Look at the breath. Oh, maybe it gives a possibility to shift your perspective somewhat or look at it from a more calmer point of view rather than just the constant reactivity all the time. And then in the Buddhist tradition, there's also many different practices the Buddha introduced to help us work with various aspects of ourself in various ways. I mean, I mentioned already there's 40 different meditation objects. So sometimes I usually recommend starting off with a simple one first, like breathing. But then you may notice that, you know, there's certain issues come up that keep returning again and again and again. So it may be helpful to bring in another meditation exercise. The second most common meditation exercise in the Theravada tradition is the practice of metta, or friendliness. So I'm just giving Brock a plug here for his day-long in 2 weeks. Metta and mindfulness, or mindful metta, or loving-kindness mindfulness or something. Haven't got a title yet, have you?
One of those.
Okay. But practice of friendliness, I tend to explain it, practice of friendliness, in a little bit different way than normal, because I had trouble with it. I translated metta as friendliness, and many different ways you can translate it. Usually, maybe most popular is loving kindness or something, and I have to admit, I'm not a love character. Love was a bit too idealistic for me, but I can be friendly, you know. So I'm not totally miserable. I mean, totally. I'm not a loving person, but I'm a friendly one, something like that. Because sometimes, especially if you have kind of very strong or empowered or energized issues, one of the most helpful tools is to try to be more friendly towards it. That sound crazy? Yeah? Okay, it's nice. It's easy to be friendly to your concentration or your mindfulness, but to be friendly to your anger? Huh? Anybody got that? You don't have to love it, you see. I don't love my anger, but I can be friendly to it because it is an aspect of me at this particular time, you see. So if I'm angry to my anger, I'm just locked into anger. But if I can be friendly to it, relate to it in a more friendly way, it just shifts. And sometimes it can totally unravel it. Doesn't mean I love it. Doesn't mean I have to. And I wouldn't say, some people talk about self-acceptance. I don't think you have to accept it either. I say be receptive to it. Be receptive to it. It is a reality. So you can't just dismiss it, but you can be receptive to it. And if you're receptive to it with a calmer state of mind and a more a wiser approach, it's different. And you can actually then begin to befriend some of your unpleasant aspects of yourself. And be friendly with them, they get transformed then to friendly anger. It's not as bad as angry or ugly anger, is it? You know? So there's a start, at least a possibility of a start of shifting the relationship to it. And then there were other particular practices. I mean, in the you may have recognized when I went up to have my meal, some people went up there to offer me the meal. The practice of generosity is very highly practiced and recognized and supported in the Theravada tradition anyway. That I recognize I live in Thailand quite a bit of my monastic life, and the Thai people really develop the art of generosity, especially to monks. And I realize this is a very fundamental spiritual practice. So we talk about it, the practice of Buddhism or the Buddhist teachings. In another form, we say generosity, morality, and meditation. Sometimes we emphasize the Eightfold Path, morality, meditation, and wisdom. That's for the intellectual people. But generosity, morality, and meditation. And I realized it took me quite a long time to appreciate the importance of that, because the practice of generosity is a form of selflessness, isn't it? You have to give outside yourself, you know. You can say, you know, one way of saying it is like we have things that we identify with. These are mine. These are my things that support me and my ego. But now I give them up. So it helps support selflessness, a giving up of the ego, of the self, and its supports and props, you see. When I spent quite a bit of time in Thailand, and I was I must admit, initially I was a bit nervous about people giving me things. Especially we were up in this simple village in northeast Thailand, which is the poorest part of Thailand, and there were these villagers. You know, they'd be lining up on the road, and we walk by with our bowls, and they put some rice in the bowl. And, you know, and I had been working, I had made money myself, and, you know, I could buy my own food, actually. And probably I made more money in 1 year than they made in a whole lifetime, when you put it down to financial numbers, you see. And I was a bit nervous then to receive their food. Oh, they might be starving, they might be starving, you know. And they usually try and give the monks the best stuff. It's just the highest merit, you see, best karma. But then one time, suddenly I had a shift in my understanding. I wasn't going out there collecting their food. I was walking around to provide them an opportunity to practice generosity. Is there a difference? It eased my conscience anyway. And if the monks didn't come, they were upset. You know, some of the people, they started their day by getting up, cooking the rice and getting up, and they had to give the monks the first little handful of rice to start their day. That made their day, you see. They gave this rice to the monks, and then, now I have started off with spiritual nourishment. And then you feed the body. So I was just thinking in terms of, you know, kind of economically speaking, but it doesn't work that way. It's not economics, you know, and it's not how much rice you give, you know. It's the act of giving up, of surrendering, of giving up of yourself, a little bit of yourself every day. Then when I came to teach in the West more often, there were quite a few people I realized they come to spiritual practice to get something, right? Me too. I was gonna get enlightened in Thailand, and I was there for a while. And remember one time I was with Ajahn Chah, and he said, "You know, I must have read my mind." Actually, he said, "You know, I can't give you any wisdom. All I can give you is patience." I was really disappointed. I came all this way for wisdom, and he can't give it to me. And again, it took me a while to understand what he meant. That the real wisdom is what you realize for yourself. And at one time I was staying with him, and I realized that I was actually feeding off his wisdom. Yeah, we go to his little hut in the evening and sit there, and he would be talking to people and discussing, you know, different issues with people, and I could stay totally awake all night, just buzzed out with hearing his profound wisdom. And then one night I went there, and he said, about 6 o'clock, he said, "Okay, finish for the night, you know, go back to your own hut to meditate." So, I got to go back. So I sort of headed back to my hut at 6 o'clock at night. And the further I got from Ajahn Chah and the closer to my hut, the tireder I felt. And I got there, and I just fell right asleep. And I realized I'm feeding off his energy, you know. I haven't got my own, I'm feeding off his, you know. We call it the bored wisdom. And if you keep doing that, and then now he died. So I can't feed off his wisdom anymore. He's gone. I would have collapsed. But what he meant by giving us patience, he provided the environment that we can keep practicing. The framework, the encouragement, keep practicing, and many, many years of confusion and doubt and uncertainty. I wanted to go to him and say, "Am I any closer to enlightenment?" Yeah. He'd say, "Well, I don't know. Check it out for yourself." He wouldn't give a straight answer. "Well, what do you think? Are you any wiser?" But he provided the framework and the encouragement for us to keep up the practice, and eventually things began to become a little bit more clearer. And he emphasized the importance of answering your own questions, being your own teacher. Of course, within the context of having him there, if you really were floundering in doubt and really uncertain, you could ask him. And if he recognized that you really were, you know, kind of falling apart, then he'd give you some encouragement. But if he saw that you were, you know, just trying to feed off his strength, you would kind of, well, maybe, you know, well, you find out for yourself. Huh? What do you think about it? Huh? Or if you thought you were really kind of skiving on your own practice and depending upon him too much, he'd send you off to one of the remote branch monasteries where you have to eat sticky rice and bananas for the next 2 months. But the practice, and then there's generosity, and then there's morality. And the practice of morality, this is a source of great self-knowledge. And we have this basic standard, the five precepts, and there's many ways, many refinements, ways you can refine those practices. You refrain from killing, for example. Well, living in Thailand with all these mosquitoes, that's a nice idea. Now put that into practice. They're chewing on my body. Well, actually, the mosquito isn't. He doesn't choose you. He's just they're just thirsty for. They need blood. It's instinctual. They need blood to be able to feed the eggs to survive. And it's just a program. They're just a physiological program. They're not picking on you. Of course, you think they're after me, you know. And I attracted quite a few mosquitoes. I must have had sweet blood or something. But of course, you know, you also need to be practical. I mean, some of the mosquitoes, they give you malaria and dengue fever. It can be dangerous. And there's various ways now we can follow these different. But you have to know yourself. They aren't rules that are going to be punished by God. Nobody's watching you except yourself, you see. And in Buddhism, it's the principle of cause and effect, automatic. You know, if the action is unskillful, then you get an unskillful result. If it's skillful, you get a skillful result or beneficial result. So you have to know yourself. You know, where am I in the context of these particular standards, guidelines for skillful living? They aren't rules, commandments from God. They're guidelines for skillful living. And sometimes they recognize, well, where am I within that standard? You know, can I really follow them? And to what degree of refinement? Some maybe I'm a little bit lax on or something. Some I find very easy to follow. Living in a cave, it's very easy to follow right speech. You only swear at yourself. But then when you go out to another situation, maybe you got to be a bit more mindful, be careful what you say. Because and something like the fifth one about intoxication. I mean, you can take it literally or look at the spirit behind it. So they're framed in the form of refraining from. It's a training to be undertaken to refrain from these particular, because if you step beyond the boundary, you're going to get into trouble, you know, karmic trouble. God's not going to punish you. You'll get into karmic trouble because they're the boundary of between skillfulness and unskillfulness. But you know, with one like intoxication, it literally means to refrain from drink and drugs which lead to heedlessness. It's literally what it means, literally. So if somebody says, well, how about if you have drink and drugs that don't cause heedlessness? Mm-hmm, getting too clever here. And what do you define as heedlessness? You know, maybe drinking two cups of coffee makes you heedless, huh? Drinking one cup of coffee nowadays makes me heedless. My mind is frazzled. So I would say it's not being very mindful, you know, just drinking coffee. But it's not literally written into the guideline, but drink or drugs which lead to heedlessness. So I usually think of liquor and narcotic drugs or something. I don't know about psychedelics. Maybe it makes you more heedful. I don't know. I better not get into some kind of moral discussion here because we might get into an argument. Somebody asked me once, what if there's some drugs that make you more heedful? I said, I never heard of such a thing. But some of them maybe you think you're more heedful. You know? I remember somebody was saying about, somebody smoked some marijuana, and the musicians thought they were playing beautiful music, and the audience said it was terrible. So it's pretty relative what's wonderful, especially when your mind is not very clear. But just trying to use these precepts as a standard for self-awareness, to know, you know, what kind of behavior that you do, and how it relates to the standard of the precepts. Takes quite a bit of not only clarity but honesty too. You have to be very, very honest about yourself. Like speech, right speech. You know, behind it is intention. So maybe you say something a little bit directly to somebody. Where is it coming from? Is it coming from you really have in mind their welfare, or are you just being nasty to them? Huh? You have to know your intention to be really clear about if you can keep the standard of these precepts. And then they all support meditation. And once you're really clear about the precepts, basically relate to your physical actions and your speech. And meditation is more concerned with your state of mind. And the Buddha says that karma, is intention. So, you know, you apply this to your actions then. I mean, we do various actions, but the important part behind it is the intention behind it. So this is, you know, intention is quite subtle, isn't it? You know what your intentions are? What is intention? Because it is a state of mind or an aspect of mind, it's very subtle and it's changing quite frequently. When I was first in Thailand, I had an experience of this, even though I didn't recognize it at the time, because one thing that Ken didn't quite get right was I didn't go to Thailand to be a monk. I went there to be a meditator. I was just going to go for 1 month, get enlightened, and come home. And be my happy old self. I mean, be myself, but happy, or something like that. Myself, my old self, but enlightened too, or something. But then when I stayed there, the longer I stayed there, the more I realized that this is more than just a one-month activity here. So I had 2 months I had to stay. And then it was 3 months, and then it was 4 months, and then finally 9 years passed. I'm still trying. But in the process, every 2 weeks, I had to stop and think, okay, do I stay here and continue with my meditation practice, or do I leave and continue my travels? So I had to look in my mind each time. What's my intention? Should I stay or should I go? And sometimes the intention was, I would say, quite noble. You know, the longer I stay here and the closer I get to enlightenment, the better I will be and the world will be. Other times it wasn't so noble. You know, it's too cold in Canada to go back this winter. Or this Thai food is pretty good here. So I realized it could be very different for basically the same activity. You know, I could stay there, you know, to get enlightened, or I could stay in Thailand because it was cold in Canada. Same activity, but different intention. And of course, it was, you know, not only changing all the time, but I mean, there were different levels of this intention. Maybe on the surface, I think underneath there was always this aspiration to get enlightened. But sometimes it got overshadowed by the taste of the food or whatever, weather conditions. At least I can rationalize it that way anyway. So really, the Buddhist practice then, generosity, morality, meditation, they all work together. That's how the spiritual path gets harmonized. And sometimes it's easier, you can say, to practice generosity, not just monetary generosity, but, you know, giving your time to help other people, sharing your time, sharing your knowledge, sharing your space or whatever. You know, it's any act of giving up of yourself, of surrendering yourself. You know, you could say, well, I don't want to be bothered with that person. Stay with myself. Or I can, you know, give up of my personal space or my personal energy or something. Sometimes you know, working with the precepts is more helpful. I know one of our supporters in New Zealand. He was born in Burma, came to New Zealand. So he grew up with a Buddhist background. So he really affirmed that he keeps the five precepts his whole life. Then he was a lawyer, and you know, the lawyers at his lawyer firm, on Friday night at 5 o'clock, they all have happy hour. And he says, I don't go. I keep the five precepts, you know, and it was looked down upon, you know. You know, you're not a proper New Zealand lawyer if you don't come to happy hour. You're not part of the crew. You aren't part of the you know, you aren't bonding with the rest of us, you know. But he, no, I keep the five precepts strictly. And then he went along to the meeting and drank water. He went along to the happy hour and drank water, and that made him happy, you know. So, but then I think the other people got a little bit nervous because they might have been doing things which were a little bit not so appropriate, and he was there sober and watching them. So they let him off happy hour. But even though he faced the pressure of work, but he kept his principles, you know. And it turned out that he got more clients because they trusted him more than the others. Because here was somebody who's sober and sane and correct and has real principles. He's not going to fudge the line. If you fudge the line on that one, how many other lines do you fudge? Huh? Especially in the legal profession. Huh? So he got much more people were more trusting of him than they were of the other lawyers, you see. Other times we had the opportunity to develop our meditation practice. And so, you know, if you know about these particular aspects of spiritual practice, then you can apply them in different situations accordingly. And if you feel in your situation which is a bit frustrating to do formal meditation exercises, well, you can practice your right speech there. You can practice your generosity there, you know. So there's many different practices the Buddha introduced to help us, support us in spiritual practice. So if we're able to understand what these are, and we can apply them in our particular life situation in the 21st century, they're still just as applicable. Maybe the details are different. You know, for example, you probably won't be seeing any monks walking through Victoria with their alms bowl tomorrow morning. Should I try it? I might go hungry. Maybe there are other ways to practice generosity, you know, not the traditional way in Thailand. So it's Christmas time nearly, yeah? Yeah, so there's a time to practice generosity. Yeah? There's certain, even all these so-called hindrances, there's a certain level of them which are normal. We need to defend ourselves. You know, at just an instinctual level. I mean, the body defends itself from pain. You know, and we need to defend our, you can say something like the integrity of the self, integrity of our particular point of reference of as a self. We need to defend it to a certain degree because we need it. We depend upon it for functioning in the world, in life. But when it becomes obsessive, when it becomes compulsive, then it can be a problem. And where that point is, we have to be clear about it ourselves, because each one of us has our own sense of our vulnerability or whatever. See? Yeah. Some people feel more vulnerable than others, so they may be a bit more defensive maybe, or they're more sensitive than others. And so you just need to be able to negotiate that kind of area of our experience. And like I put down those in that the hindrances, the five hindrances, to me they're, I ask the question, why is there only five? You know, I notice a lot more, you know, hundreds, you know. But I don't know if the Buddha did this or not, but I rationalize it that it's the five fundamental energetics of our being. The sensual desire is reaching out, the aversion is pushing away, the sleepiness and dullness is a kind of collapse of energy. Restlessness is a overexpression of it, and doubt is kind of paralysis. Kind of five basic energetics. So if you notice, you know, not particularly one of these specific five, but if you notice something else, a typical one which is mentioned in the scriptures but not as a hindrance is envy or jealousy. It's a very prominent one too. Well, to me, that's more like that's close to a pushing away. Yeah, you don't like them. You're envious of them. You judge them. So it's closer to aversion. Another one somebody pointed out was fear. And I had this little discussion with my editor because she was saying that she thinks fear is aversion. And to me, fear is related to doubt because we're afraid of what we don't know. And then fear manifests and then we get averse to the fear. So aversion is a reaction to the fear rather than the source of the fear. Got that? Yeah. And somebody recently, they mentioned to me about they were struggling with restlessness. They had a lot of restlessness. They were struggling with it, trying to find ways to deal with it and work with it. And I think it was they were reading my book about it, and somehow they realized that, you know, when we look at this restlessness, actually, look at it first. So they began to investigate it, and they found that it wasn't actually restlessness. It was doubt. The root of it was doubt, and it was manifest as restlessness. If you don't know, you know, you're not clear about what's going on, then it can lead to restlessness because you're looking all over for a solution to it. But if you recognize it's based upon doubt, aha, now she tried for, I don't know, quite a long time struggling with restlessness, and no, it didn't work, nothing worked. But when she realized that it was based on doubt, aha, then when she get down to the basis of it, then she could do something with it, and that restlessness went away. Because the root of it was the doubt, not the restlessness. It's like you're shadow boxing, you see, with the restlessness, but it's not the real issue. The real issue is down there, looking in the wrong place. So that's why the Buddha pointed out to be aware very clearly of what these issues are. Is it really aversion? Yeah. Maybe it's fear behind it. You know, maybe a lot of our aversion is fear. Like you're frightened that your defenses are going to be, you know, impinged upon or something. So you react with aversion, but the real issue is the fear. Feeling lack of confidence and fear about being threatened, you know, not the aversion itself. It's a reaction to the reaction, you know. human beings are very complicated. So I think we're after 4:30 now. So should I finally stop talking?